You need to know about Lindsey Graham. He has died somewhat mysteriously after meetings in Ukraine. Also, the Iran war is once again a hot war. And an Australian journalist embarrasses herself on national television.
Source your claim. When did Iran have a nuclear weapons program?
We're not going to get into a debate about that because we're going to...
It's very difficult for you to tolerate anything that goes against your narrative, isn't it?
Honestly, he was a great politician. He was really a talented, you know, I don't say, you probably never heard me say that about anybody because, you know, there aren't too many of them, let me tell you.
The war and the man who loved it. We call this the Sanchez effect, so let's get started. Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. You know, like a lot of people over the weekend, when I got the news about the sudden death of Lindsey Graham, I immediately started trying to work through it, right? And I thought to myself, what am I going to say about this, right? It's one of those stories that really tests us, me as a journalist, but also any one of us as human beings. Because, you know, I mean, I'm a Christian. My parents taught me that it's wrong to talk ill of the dead. But what do you do if the person who died was themselves responsible for deaths, was responsible for cheering on wars, cheering on the deaths of thousands of people, and bespoke it openly, cruelly? Do you ignore it? Or do you mention it? Right? So maybe here's what we should do. What I'm thinking I should do is I should just share my own story regarding Lindsey Graham. Because I've been around for a while and I've covered the guy for a long time. I started covering him in 1999. That's the first time that we were working together on something. He was arguing for the impeachment of Bill Clinton. And at the time, to me, by the way, I agreed with it because of what Bill Clinton had done at the time. It seemed to me at the time like he was a measured guy, a reasonable guy, certainly compared to some of the colleagues at the time who were trying to make different arguments. But as the years went on, right, and he started becoming different. In fact, he started becoming anything but reasonable. He became extremist, you know, a guy who seemed to revel in wars over and over again. Not one war, all wars. And he seemed to revel in death. And that's not me saying it. That's Lindsey Graham saying it. Here he is.
I've been saying for 6 months now, hit Iran. They have oil fields out in the open. They have the Revolutionary Guard headquarters you can see from space. Blow it off the map.
Was it worth to America to take down a religious Nazi regime who's trying to build a nuclear weapon to deliver to America? That's a really good investment.
We're going to do everything we can to push forward to make Iran's worst nightmare real.
We should tell the Russians in no uncertain terms, you interfered in our elections. We don't care why. We're going to hit you and hit you hard.
And we're going to make Russia, under U.S. law, what they are, terrorists.
I'm here with President Zelensky. I am such a admirer of what you and your country have done. You're trying to stop the Russians so we don't have to fight them.
I like the structural path we're on here. As long as we help Ukraine with the weapons they need and the economic support, they will fight to the last person.
Putin, your turn is coming. You know, Donald Trump is the Scotty Scheffler of American politics and foreign diplomacy, and he's about to put a whooping on your ass.
Free Cuba. Stay tuned. Yeah. The liberation of Cuba is upon us. It's just a matter of time now. You see this, that? Make Iran great. President Trump said the only way to make Iran great is for the people to take over. We're marching through the world. We're cleaning out the bad guys. We're going to have relationships with new people that will make us prosperous.
And again, look, not my words, not your words, his words. It's what he stood for. Maybe you agree with him. And what was his last act in all of this? He was in Kyiv trying to make sure another war continued. Got the pictures. You know, Mr. Graham, Senator Graham never seemed to want wars to end. Ukraine war was no different. I mean, there he seemed to not care if Ukrainians and Russians died in this war that, by the way, he both stoked and provoked as you watch these pictures of him. Look, you name the country. Lindsey Graham wanted it destroyed and proclaimed America's right to do so and kill its people if need be. He would say it. He said that, or certainly suggested it, about China, Iraq, Syria. Said it about Russia. Just heard him. Lebanon, Palestine. In fact, he seemed to want to say that about any country or place inhabited by Muslims. I mean, for Lady Lindsay, as he was often known as, all of this was fair game. Something else you should know about him. He was not openly gay. He was just gay. Not openly gay, just gay. And he worked hard to make sure that people didn't know that he was gay by voting against any and all measures that would in any way favor gay Americans. So he was against gays in the military, right? Wanted them banned. He was also against gays being able to form legal unions. Voted against it every time. He was against gays ever having or earning workplace protections. And some would say that may have been a little hypocritical. What do you say? He was also known, of late especially, for appearing in public. Yeah. I mean, it could happen to anybody, but it happened to him several times, and it's out there. Appearing in public drunk. He would show up at events, and he would show up at interviews sounding like this.
We got to give them a chance to see the difference between us and liberal Democrats.
Well, what we're going to do is, well, I'm not going to agree. That would grind it to a halt. You couldn't deal with mass. We're not dealing with the
sanctuary states.
Yeah, sanctuary. Mm-hmm. Under existing law that of the United States. Okay, who's Kim Davis, folks? Nothing to do with illegal immigration. I agree with her political, philosophical, not her religious views.
He did, though, have a very ardent admirer, and here he is.
He was a great, like a gauge, a temperature gauge of the Senate. He was somebody that most Democrats liked. Some didn't, but most Democrats liked. And just about all of the Republicans liked Lindsey. He got along with everybody. And yet he was a tough cookie in a lot of ways. But he had honestly, he was a great politician. People don't realize what a good politician he was. He could go in and get something approved. He would just get people on his side. He was really a talented, you know, I don't say, you probably never heard me say that about anybody because, you know, there aren't too many of them, let me tell you.
You know who else loved him? The Western television networks, right? CBS, for example. So this is a network which, like Lindsey Graham, is owned by Israel. And they posted a report on his death that it was a glowing obituary of him. They're right to do so. But I watched it, and then I went down and looked at the comments, and I read the comments. Look at the comments. These are just the first, like, 5-6 comments right from the top, right? Finally, after 18 months, something that makes America great again, wrote one viewer. Another one said, good riddance to an evil monster. This is after watching a report on him that was positive. The devil called him back home, says somebody else. God said that's enough, says another one. You know, and divine intervention was like a common theme with all of these questions about how he died. It's pretty shady the way that he died all of a sudden, said one comment, while another one wrote, he died of shame. By the way, we do basically know how he died, although when it was first reported about Graham's death, and it seemed to come out of nowhere, every single report seemed to mention that he had died of some recent illness. But there's no knowledge of what that illness may have been. Since then, doctors have performed an autopsy. And what we've learned is that he died of something called an aortic inception, right? Or a dissection, pardon me. Which basically means that his aorta, the most important valve in your heart, just busted. It bled out, so to speak. And that's the way doctors say that he died. They say it happens to men of his age from time to time. And sometimes there are no signs of it unless they've had some kind of proper testing. I don't know if he did or didn't, but I guarantee you the reports will soon be that it was the Russians somehow who caused that. Now let's talk about the war in Iran. There's new information. This thing just got really hot. So the U.S. has been bombing missile and air defense systems, mostly in southern Iran, we understand. U.S. officials also say that they're going to be hitting small naval boats. In fact, they already have, in the Strait of Hormuz. Iran is, of course, firing right back there. There's reports of a relentless assault on U.S. bases, mostly in Jordan and Kuwait so far. But Iran has also been targeting Bahrain, Qatar, and Oman throughout the course of the day. This is just what's happening. One of the most intriguing stories, once again, coming out of this matchup is the weaponry. It doesn't even make sense. Fars is reporting that Iran is having remarkable success penetrating U.S. missile defense systems. For example, drones are being used to destroy the HIMARS launchers that the U.S. put in Kuwait. I've got video of that. Take a look at some of these pictures that are coming in from Kuwait. Look at these. The Iranians say that they've hit these HIMARS and that they're going to be used to fire into Iranian territory, which is why they did this. The agency also says that three ballistic missiles were fired toward Kuwait's Al-Mina area and the site housing a U.S. ATACMS missile system. Now, as I show you these pictures, I want you to think about that for a minute, because this is kind of the pattern that's developed. Think about drones that cost, what, a couple $1,000s? Are being used to knock out weapon systems that cost tens of millions of dollars each. So that's where we are. Then there's also this. U.S. commanders are saying that they have hit Kisham Island. That's near the strait. And this is a video of what that looks like. Iranians have confirmed the attack. And some of the videos that have been shared are from that location taken by locals. So Iran's hitting U.S. Facilities, and the U.S. is hitting Iran's facilities. Now let's talk about the Strait of Hormuz. Here's what we know. Iranians say they will let ships continue to go through as long as they are not ships from countries that are attacking them or that are allied with countries that are attacking them. And that is the situation there. If you want to know, by the way, what's really happening in the Iran war, and it makes me think of this. Let me put this down so you can see. If you really want to know what's happening in the Iran war and how crazy this story is, you need only to listen to how Western media members, my colleagues, often frame this story. I found one in particular. There's this woman in Australia, right? She's interviewing Mohamed Mirandi. And watch how she frames this. Watch how she blames the fact. This is crazy. Talk about victim blaming. She blames the fact that Iranians are suffering not because of the actions of the people who attack them. She's blaming Iran for allowing its people to suffer. Listen.
However bold your statements are in defense of Iran, it's still a country in the midst of an economic crisis. Many of the population, as much as 40% of the population, lives below the poverty line. The war has badly damaged your industrial base. Don't the people of Iran deserve a chance for peace?
Well, that's your problem, isn't it? Your aggression.
I think the question is about the people of Iran. I'm asking you a question about whether the people of Iran deserve a chance for peace and to establish some economic future for the country.
Don't your people deserve peace after all? Look what happened to them. They were attacked. And think about the framing that she's posing there. She's literally ignoring the fact that it was a country and a people that were attacked and seems to be lecturing Iranians, and in this case, Professor Mirandi, for daring to want to defend themselves. What's your excuse for dying? She seems to be asking. My goodness. It's like a Fellini movie, like a crazy world we're living in. Watch, here's Mirandi's response.
It's very difficult for you to tolerate anything that goes against your narrative, isn't it? It is your problem because you have supported aggression against Iran. If the Iranian people are suffering, It is because wars that your regime has helped enable by supporting Trump, by supporting the United States. Three wars have been imposed upon our country for the last 47 years. All three were supported by the United States, and in all three, the United States was directly involved. The maximum pressure sanctions on the Iranian people are because Iran supports the Palestinian people while your government supports the genocide.
He's right. I checked. The Australian government has only recently begun to criticize Israel, but it's more because more than half of Australians now condemn Israel. So it was the people that led the government, not the government that led the people. And she works for the government, by the way. I'll tell you more about that in a minute. She continues in this interview to sound extremely biased with her, let me just say it, unsubstantiated reporting.
If the conflict continues, the USA will not deliver the billions of dollars in unfrozen assets to Iran, as was agreed under the terms of the MOU. Doesn't Iran need that cash to rebuild the country?
You mean, when you mean frozen assets, you mean stolen assets, right?
I mean what I said.
And in addition,
I mean
those...
exactly what I said. Frozen assets under sanctions.
Yes, you mean stolen.
Delivered to the Iranian government because of its development of a nuclear weapons program. Go ahead.
Don't be too cowardly. Stolen assets.
He's calling her out, and good for him, because he's right. No government has the right to use or take the assets of another government. But the United States and Western countries frequently take it upon themselves to seize the legal assets of a country or a company or even of a person simply because they disagree with their politics. I don't like the way you think, so I'm taking your stuff. The stuff you had in that bank? No, can't use it anymore. Sometimes they do it for no reason at all. And by the way, and this is something she should know, but I don't think she understands, because that would require reading. This has a backlash not on the countries whose assets are being frozen, but on the United States and other Western countries, because it affects their banking system, because it affects their monetary system. And this Aussie talking head, whatever the hell her name is, conducting this interview, she doesn't appear to recognize that. Nor can she in any way try to even back up. It's okay to say something or get something wrong. I say things wrong all the time, make mistakes. I'm a human being. But when somebody tells you what you said is unsubstantiated, it's wrong, you should try and clear it up, right? Well, here she is when he goes back and says, what is this report you say of Iran's nuclear weapons program? Tell me more. Watch.
What was an Iranian nuclear weapons program? Where is your evidence of this? Where did we have a nuclear weapons program?
I'm just asking
source
you to
your claim.
Answer the question
source
if you
your
would.
Claim.
Doesn't
source your claim.
Doesn't Iran need
You're a journalist.
Doesn't Iran
source.
Need the money? Source. Doesn't Iran need that money to rebuild the country?
First, source your claim. When did Iran have a nuclear weapons program?
We're not going to get into a debate about that because we've got about a minute left to discuss. I want to stick to the subjects of the day.
Yes. She wants to stick to the subject of the day. It's like, what? In other words, she can't defend what she just said. She can't substantiate her claim as a fact. This is what they do. It's God bless them, man. They're just called, you know what? It's called bad journalism, also known as Western journalism these days. I know. I used to be one of them. I used to do it, you know, I'm sorry to say. You get caught up in it, I guess. By the way, there are few things that are more embarrassing to a journalist than to be caught red-handed, fabricating information, just making something up, or just repeating it because you've heard somebody else say it, which is kind of probably what she's doing. And by the way, most legitimate news outlets would go and call her that night and say, you got to correct this, or you got to explain it, or you got to give it context, or you got to apologize for the mistake you made. And sometimes they even fire people when they do stuff like that. But in the West, that only happens if your mistake affects one of their protectorates, you know? Like, you can't insult the UK or Germany or France, and you certainly can't insult Israel. But if you get something wrong or you say something terrible that's about Iran or China or Russia or Cuba or Venezuela Right, any Arab country, of course, any African country, and of course, little people of Latin America, they don't matter. You could say whatever the hell you want about them. Pretty much say whatever the hell you want, no matter how wrong it is. And the next day, guess what? You're going to have your job. It's going to be right there on the platter for you. In fact, more often than not, you're probably going to get a promotion. Could even get a raise. And this reporter who just interviewed Morandi, I looked her up, of course. I went and checked. No correction, no context, nothing to her line of questioning. She hasn't apologized. And yes, she continues to work for, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. In other words, state TV. All right, so when we come back, we have to talk about the potential nightmare scenario that can come out of this war in Iran. And just how bad might things get for people around the world if this nightmare scenario actually happens? I'm going to be joined by none other than Chris Halali. He is in Tehran, as a matter of fact. He's going to be joining us. By the way, as we go to break, I encourage you to check us out on BitChute, as well as all the other social media places. Because on BitChute, that's where my stuff lives permanently, because it's the only social media platform where I, as a creator, can be guaranteed that it'll be safe. No one's going to knock it out. No one's going to cancel it. No one's going to demonetize it. No one's going to make it disappear. It's in the contract when you join. We'll be right back. All right, let's do this. We just got some breaking news. While we were in the break, Boris, my producer, got in my ear and told me that we've got some video coming in because this thing could be escalating. I got some pictures I want to share with you now. This is the Sana'a Airport. Watch this. This is crazy. You're actually going to watch the missiles falling from the sky, hitting the runways and destroying them. Those are airplanes you're seeing in the background. Boom. According to Reuters, by the way, because I just checked, we're not the only ones reporting this. The Houthis are saying the Saudis are attacking them as we speak. So these are the Saudis firing missiles into Yemen. Perhaps bringing Yemen more into this war between Israel, the United States, and Iran. Keep in mind, Yemen is an ally. The Houthis are allies of the Iranians, and they will come to Iran's defense. Some would argue they already have. This is, once again, the Sana'a Airport in Yemen being attacked by the Saudis. Wow. Joining us now. Is somebody who is very close to this situation. As a matter of fact, he's so close to this situation, he's actually in Tehran right now. Chris Halali is good enough to join us. Chris, I understand you're there. You're following the situation. I know you may not know about this. I'm not sure. I don't want to put you in a, you know, on the spot here because this just crossed like minutes ago for me. But is there anything you can add to what I just said about these attacks? Between now the Saudis as they hit Yemen.
Yes, absolutely. I've been very close and monitoring the situation since early morning. I was with the delegation from Yemen, from Ansar Allah, throughout the entire funeral of Imam Khamenei. And I spoke very closely with many of the top officials that arrived in Iran for the first time in a decade, breaking the blockade on air travel that was imposed by Saudi Arabia and its coalition. And early this morning at about 4 a.m., I was told by the Yemeni delegation that they were on their way to the airport. The plane took off. It was Mahan Airlines. It's an Iranian national airlines. It was a 747 Boeing. And it was taking a new route because it didn't want to cross over the Gulf straight through. So as it was approaching, the Saudi Arabian Air Force began bombarding the Sana'a Airport. And the Iranians had already prepared for this, as had the Yemenis. So it landed in Al Hodeida, which is on the seaside. It's a port city, and it had an airport as well. The Saudis had not targeted it, so the airline was able to land once again, breaking once again the air blockade. However, very shortly thereafter, Yahya Sari, the spokesman of the Yemeni military, announced that this is the end of the ceasefire, and Yemen will respond proportionally and aggressively against Saudi aggression against the Yemeni people and Yemeni state. And also, the Bab al-Mandeb is in play, also to be closed, as well, as early reports have indicated. So there's a lot going on, and I think Yemen is very much going to be dragged into this right away.
Let's talk about that, what you just said, because I think this is really important. You know, look, if this was just a skirmish between Yemen and Saudi Arabia, you know, that ship has sailed. I've seen that before. I've been covering those skirmishes for the last at least 5-6 years. What's different here is that the Strait of Hormuz is already either shut down or arguably shut down. And that's where 15 to 20% of the resources that go to the world comes out of. If the Strait of Al-Mandab is also shut down, that's the one that goes into the Red Sea. Some would argue it could be even more, another 15%. We're talking about 30% of the world's petroleum, hydrocarbons, gas, oil, fertilizer, you name it. The only way it can get through the Mediterranean is through there. If the Yemenis or the Houthis do in the Strait of Al-Mandeb the same thing that the Iranians have done in the Strait of Hormuz, my goodness, look at this. I'm showing it to you there. The Bab al-Mandeb Strait is on the lower part of your screen. Strait of Hormuz on the upper part of your screen. If both of those straits are shut down, one can only begin to imagine the kind of horror it would cause economically. Chris, to you.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. In fact, as former president of the Russian Federation, Dmitry Medvedev, who came to Tehran for Imam Khamenei's funeral and paid his respects on behalf of President Putin, he said on the plane back that Iran has this so-called nuclear weapon being the Strait of Hormuz, and Yemen has this nuclear weapon being the Bab al-Mandeb Strait. So the Russians clearly understand that these two choke points are very critical for the global economy. Many other countries have also acknowledged this. And you're absolutely right. If they are shut down together, this will be a massive blow to the economy. It will create, no doubt, a recession at the very least, if not an outright depression, worse than 2008 economic crisis. And I think that this would be a major blow to the efforts of the United States and of Israel to continue to pursue their regime change and their military aggression against Iran and other neighboring countries. So this is a very big moment. If this happens, this will be, I really believe, world-shattering in many ways.
Yeah, and look, that's just the beginning of it, because I gotta play something for you. You know George Galloway. I know both you and I have been with George Galloway in the past together here in Moscow. And you also know Professor Morandi. So Professor Morandi was just with George, and George asked him, if the United States continues to attack Iran, what might Iran do specifically? And here's the response from Morandi, and it's kind of scary when you think about what the causality of this would be in the places that Iran might hit. Let's take a listen to him.
If Iran's critical infrastructure is targeted in a significant way, then the critical infrastructure of these countries in the Persian Gulf, George, will be destroyed. And people can look up the temperature right now in Dubai and in other cities and the humidity. If they lose their electricity, if they lose their water, people will have to evacuate immediately. And if the United States uses ground troops, those troops will be supported, will be sent from these countries, and they'll be supported by their bases in these countries. So what is Iran supposed to do? These countries will be a part of the war effort. If the United States intensifies this war, as I said 3-4 months ago, that will bring an end to these countries, these small regimes in the Persian Gulf, which are just deserts, with oil and gas.
Talk about hitting their oil facilities, talk about hitting their gas facilities, talk about making sure that there's no fertilizer that is coming out of there. And most of all, you heard what he said at the beginning. He didn't use the word desalination plants, but that's exactly what I believe he's referring to, hitting desalination plants that would all but make these places unlivable.
You're absolutely right. I mean, we're on the precipice of catastrophe if the United States and its allies in the region continue to pursue this aggressive and hostile these aggressive and hostile acts And ultimately, this policy, which is to basically have a regime change in Tehran, though they don't say it, they continue to push back against every acknowledged and agreed upon condition in the memorandum of understanding, which was agreed upon via the Pakistan delegation. So I think that it's clear that Iran has committed to all of its parts. It did not attack. This was once again aggression on the side of the United States. And Professor Mirandi is exactly right. If this continues and it's supported by the U.S. bases in the Gulf, then the Gulf states will bear responsibility for having brought upon this war against Iran. And if that happens, as he says, now it's very hot, I can tell you. It's very warm up here in Tehran. I can only imagine the heat. 45 to 50 degrees Celsius we're talking about in the Gulf. If we're talking about cutting out electricity, desalination plants, and you name it, these places will become uninhabitable, as you rightfully point out. Yeah. So this is a very serious time. And the United States needs to understand that it will lose its allies in the region if it continues to pursue this policy.
And by the way, for those of you from my side of the world, that would be about 120 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's, yeah, it's a very difficult situation. It would be like one of the worst days in the Mojave Desert or somewhere in Arizona, for example. So let me ask you about what's happening right now that could possibly change this. Do you still believe that the United States will, and Israel, I suppose, and all the people who are kind of making this happen right now will look, for example, at the scenes that you saw? Because you just mentioned that they want a regime change, but I just saw 12 million people on the streets of Tehran. The only person, and I looked this up, who's ever had a bigger funeral was Tito in Yugoslavia, by the way. 12 million people is more than Lenin's funeral, JFK's funeral, FDR's funeral, Churchill's funeral, all combined. Doesn't that send a signal that the people of Iran are at least, at the very least, okay with their government? That would keep somebody from not wanting to tear them away from their government?
Absolutely. And listen, I was a part of the funeral processions in Tehran. I then went to the Center of Religious Study in the holy city of Qom. And then, of course, Imam Khamenei's body, along with his family members, went to Baghdad, Najaf, and Karbala, and then came back to the holy city of Mashhad to be interred at the shrine of Imam Reza. In total, 40 to 50 million people came out between the two countries. That's enormous. We're talking about that's bigger than many countries in the world in terms of population. So if they're looking for a referendum on Iran's government, clearly the people of Iran have shown that they are very much supporting their government and their nation at this time. And I want to make clear that the legacy of Imam Khamenei at this point, which is very part of what we're seeing now, was about, first and foremost, the Palestinians. And he called 15 years ago for a one-state solution. So long as the Palestinians continue to be under a genocidal regime, an apartheid regime, there will be no peace in the region. Unless there is justice for the Palestinians, for the Lebanese, for the Syrians, for all the people in the region, there will be no justice and there will be no peace. So that's what we've heard on the streets all along. All these days, we've heard that so long as they continue a policy of colonialism, imperialism, and continue to push and oppress the people of the region, there won't be any peace, and they will continue to pursue their policies, and in return, the Iranians and their allies will continue to pursue self-defense. And that was just what's going to happen, unless you address the root causes. By the way, you and I know that the root causes are critical not only for this situation, but also in the war and the special military operation in Ukraine. If the root causes aren't addressed, there can be no peaceful solution.
You're there. And I remember when I was there and I had talks with Arachi and others, I got a sense of what they really were willing to do. So let me put it on you. What do you, how far do you believe the Iranians are willing to go? Because some of this is bravado and some of it is trying to get your enemy to back down by scaring them or threatening them, some of these things we hear. So let me ask you, do you think the Iranians are willing to go as far as it takes to respond to U.S. attacks on its people?
I believe that the Iranians now, especially after this funeral, especially after the cries and the chants and the slogans that we've heard all over the country over the past 2 weeks, I think that the Iranians are very angry. I think that the Iranian people are very upset. They want revenge. They want justice. They're not seeing justice. Everybody has told me that they want a tribunal much like Nuremberg or the Tokyo tribunal for the Americans and the Israelis. And they don't see that happening, so they see their only solution to defeat them on the battlefield so long as they continue to aggress against Iran. And you've seen that Iran has made conditions like, for example, Lebanon and many other conditions necessary for peace. And if the United States and Israel continue to violate those conditions, Iran will respond forcefully. Iran responds proportionally. Let's not say that they don't. They respond proportionally. But they will continue to inflict tremendous damage so long as damage is inflicted upon them and their allies. And that's just, I think that Iranians are willing to go to the end. They did so during the great sacred defense when Ba'athist Iraq imposed the war, which the United States supported on Iran, of which Professor Mirandi and many others, including Araghchi, Ghalibaf, Imam Khamenei himself, participated in that war. They saw firsthand what the U.S. and Western support did against the Iranian people. So they know too well what war means, and they are prepared to defend their country because they are also patriots. They have a religious conviction for justice, and they are willing to do so until justice is served.
Let me ask you a question in very interesting terms, because it's something that I've been tussling with, and you're my friend. This is the kind of thing you and I would talk about when we get together and have a cup of coffee or something, right? Do you have to be a mass killer or serial killer to be held responsible for mass killings or serial killings? I ask that question because one of the biggest ever proponents of this war that we're now talking about just died. And I had to report on it today, and I tussled with it and had a hard time doing it because I've been taught not to speak ill of the dead. But it was impossible for me to talk about his death without talking about all the deaths that he in many ways inflicted or seemed to revel in. What's your take on the death of Lindsey Graham?
Listen, I'm not going to speak ill of the man in terms of his, you know, his being. I will simply speak ill of his actions. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with speaking wrong or there's anything wrong with speaking ill about his actions, which, like you said, have led to the deaths of many, many people. In fact, I would argue millions of people, because he's been in the Senate for decades. He has watched over and been a part of the sanctions against Iraq, which, as you remember, Madeleine Albright said were necessary. They were something that she was willing to take, which killed 500,000 kids. You know, we saw the wars in Iraq, the wars in Afghanistan, regime change in Libya, regime change in Syria. We've seen now the wars in Iran twice. We've seen the genocide in Gaza. We've seen the war in Ukraine and the support for these Banderist fascists and neo-Nazi forces that have killed people in the Donbass and in the Russian Federation since 2014. We've seen support for regime change in Latin America, in Africa. So sadly, of course, I'm sure Lindsey Graham was born as a good person, as everybody is made in the image and likeness of God. But sadly, he chose the wrong path. He chose the path of violence. And he was a great purveyor of violence upon many people around the world. And as you heard in the clips that were played on the show when you opened in your monologue, His main goal was prosperity and American power. He was not interested in having a multipolar world. He wasn't interested in having equality amongst nations and friendship and solidarity and mutual prosperity, win-win economics or win-win diplomacy, as the Chinese said. He was interested in maintaining U.S. hegemony and U.S. unipolarity. And whatever that took, and he saw the Russians as terrorists, he saw the Chinese as terrorists, he saw Iran as terrorists, he saw everybody as a state sponsor of terror that was not on the side of the U.S. and the sort of Western NATO-led camp. So, sadly, that is his legacy. It's not a mark on him as a person. He's going to have to face his maker, and he's going to have to be judged for that. But we know, based on his actions and based on his record, both in and out of Congress, what kind of person he was. And sadly, he made many, many, many grave errors, and he caused the lives to be lost of many, many people around the world.
He died of what his autopsy doctors are calling an aortic dissection. I looked it up. It means essentially his heart blew out, just bled out, right? It was like a laceration in the most important valve in your heart. I'm sure you and most people who are watching this show are familiar with that. Do you think that will stop the Western media from blaming it on Russians somehow?
If the Western media has not been stopped blaming Russia for the past decades, if not, you know, near a century at this point, I don't think it's going to stop them at this point. Anything that can, blame, that they can put blame on the Russians, they will continue to do. This is part of their ongoing Russophobia. This is part of their ongoing hostility towards Russia. And we know that the media is now basically simply a vehicle. They're all stenographers for the Epstein regime, for this warmongering class. And they will continue to do so, sadly, as you saw with the Australian broadcaster. They continue not to do journalism. They continue to just, whitewash the crimes of the West and continue to basically speak the lines of the military-industrial complex and their masters who pay their salaries. Sadly, that's where the state of Western journalism lies, and I don't see it changing anytime soon.
You know, I want this war to end in Ukraine badly. I think it's a stupid war, and I want it to stop. And I want the Ukrainians to stop dying, and I want the Russians to stop dying. Seems to me that, you know, Senator Graham and others of his ilk in parts of Europe don't think like me, and I think like you. I don't want to put words in your mouth. I assume you want this thing to stop, and I assume you want it, the deaths to end as well, and the killings to end. They seem to put themselves behind this mask of being benevolent defenders of Ukraine. But they're actually not benevolent defenders of Ukraine. They're the ones who are in many ways destroying Ukraine, are they not?
Absolutely. I mean, I had the honor and privilege of traveling with you, Rick, to Starobelsk. And I wish it was under different circumstances. It was your first trip to the Donbass.
Yeah.
But we saw firsthand the flames were still roaring in some of the buildings. And we could still smell the death all around us of these 21 innocent children. Who were taken from us by these 16 or so drones that were launched against this school. I mean, those deaths are the responsibility of Lindsey Graham and all the other warmongers in Washington, in Brussels, and in other capitals in Europe and in the West, who continue to push this war of choice, really. It was a war of choice. It didn't need to be this way. The Ukrainian and Russian people are brotherly people. And you saw that on the ground when we were there.
Yes.
And you spoke with people on the ground. They have seen that Russia, they have seen that Russia is defending them. So I want this war to end, absolutely, like you do. But I want it to end justly. I want the root causes to be addressed. I don't want this to be just kicking the can down the road, so to say, and really just delaying what will be a second round of fighting. I want there to be justice. I don't want there to be Russophobia anymore. I want the Orthodox Church to be free, to have its property back, to have its religious services back, to have its hierarchy in place. I want the Russian language to continue to be taught. I want the statues and the heritage and the history of this land for 1,000 years united to be once again preserved. But sadly, we've seen that the Ukrainian regime does not want that, and their Western backers do not want that. So as long as they continue to have this aggressive stance, which is now targeting civilians, civilian infrastructure in St. Petersburg, in Moscow, and in many other cities, I don't see that this is ending unless it's going to end militarily. We don't even see that the Americans, who agreed in Anchorage to some sort of agreement with the Russians, we don't even see them being truly committed to peace. Sadly, that's the situation. And as President Putin and others have said, that will have to end militarily at this point to solve the crisis.
Final question. You're in Tehran. What is the feel tonight? What is the thinking tonight in Tehran? What are you thinking about, knowing that you are in a place that is vulnerable, that could be attacked at any moment now by missiles as we look at the city behind you, and you're there live?
I mean, I'm doing my journalistic duty. I wish that others in the West would do their journalistic duty, like you and I do, and travel to the places that we speak about and speak to the people that we claim to speak for. But I will say that many people are not afraid. The resolve is very strong in the country. This funeral has been a massive unifying event. And I think that people now are angry. They want justice. And they are prepared. They are prepared. They are a very proud people. We Iranians are a people of dignity. We are very hospitable. You know that. You've been here.
Yeah.
We love hospitality. We have a whole culture called Tarov. We love to take care of other people. But if people impose themselves on Iran, Iranians will defend themselves. Iran has not been an aggressor state for a century plus. But if others impose on Iran, Iran will defend itself fully with all of the capabilities that they've built over the years.
Yeah, and there we see some of the pictures that prove it with the tens or the millions and millions of people, 12 million at last count, who came out to the streets just recently for the funeral of their supreme leader. Chris Hilali, DD Geopolitics, great reporter, great friend all over the scene there in Tehran. And we're very appreciative for his being so gracious with his time. Good luck, Chris. We'll be talking again very soon.
Thank you so much, Rick. Take care.
That's it from us. Obviously, important day, important stories that we have been covering for you. You can obviously continue to follow some of these stories. Much of our reporting will soon be on X and YouTube and Spotify. And obviously, as I mentioned earlier, on BitChute. That's important for us because that's where you become a part of the conversation as well. And you get to share your take on some of the things we may have gotten right or we may have gotten wrong. And certainly it's okay to share. Most of all, thank you so much for letting us into your homes. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I will be looking for you again soon.